conclude.
What's that? This is the original title of my talk, but I kind of remixed a little bit of my kids. So, if anyone came for the love bit, that's the wrong idea. So, I'm not competitive, really. So it's about, that's the play on the famous Stanley Kubrick movie. I'm going to be talking about algorithmic game content generation, so the generation of graphics and other media and stuff like that in games. And today, basically my aim is to bake a cake. I'm going to be trying to bake a cake inside your head, metaphorically speaking, of course. I'm going to show you a whole bunch of different ingredients, and my hope is that we can, like, I've got to go through the 4-3 parts, so it'll be like a really fast mixer. And hopefully at the end of it, we'll come out with a cake inside your head, and we'll all go code lots of algorithmic content stuff into our open source games. So basically, during this talk, I'm going to be trying to cover these points. What is procedural content generation? What can be generated procedurally in a game? Why do we want to do this? And how do we use these algorithms practically in games? I'll address the first one now. Procedural content generation is, as opposed to when you have artists working on a game who hand create every single asset in the game, so they hand create all the 3D models, hand create all the textures, or if it's a 2D game, all the 2D art, the hand, musicians who hand create the soundtrack, the sound effects artists who hand create the sound effects. Instead of doing that, you're writing code that takes the general idea of what something is and makes as many as you want of them. So, the kinds of things that you can generate are behaviors as well as the content. So, the way that the non-player characters in the game move around and stuff like that, and also effects, so special effects. I'm just going to give a brief timeline of the game industry since the 1960s. In the early 1960s, around the time of the PDC-1, this group of dudes from MIT made a cool little game called Spaceballism. I've seen screenshots of this.
I just played it.
Oh, really? I was going to say, has anyone played it?
Played in the 60s.
This game actually had a procedural content generation in it. The ships were actually made from sine and cosine routines. They were put together to make these little spaceship shapes. But the idea of the game was you had the planet, and you had another player, and you had toggle switches on the front of the PDC-1. Correct me if I get this wrong. And you had to...
that was 40 years ago.
You had to toggle it one way, and the ship would spin one way, toggle it the other, the ship would spin the other way, and you'd go down, try to shoot each other down while interacting in the gravity of this body that's in the center of the screen. So, something interesting led on to this. In 1969, when the PDC-7 came out, a guy named Ken Thompson, who you might have heard of, he got a press release baseball game that he wrote once for Space Travel, which was like a much more realistic planetary simulator. It had a few different bodies. I don't think it had a combat element in it. I think it was more of a simulator. But, and then shortly after that, he wrote something we know as Unix. And one of the first things he ported to Unix was a friend who went by the name of Richie. Some of you might have heard of him. Was Space Travel. So one of the first Unix programs.
So now we're putting Linux on games consoles.
Yes, that's right. They've gone the whole other way around. Now we're putting Linux back on games consoles.
Just to start on that, that was one of the first reasons why game consoles now have really good.
You're right. So imagine more durable.
Quick aside. Everybody speak really loudly so that we can capture on
No problem.
I'm going to take you to talk really loudly. Yep.
So the PDP one was actually, I think it might have been the first, or one of the first definitely, examples of coded game rather than one which was made in circuitry. An example of a game made in circuitry, well, let's move to the 1970s. Games in the 1970s started being developed by one or two people. I think the Atari 2600 came out in 1978. So, yeah, it was a big decade for games. Pong, Asteroids, Space Invaders. And of course, Steve the Wozniak made Breakout in 4 days, and his good pal Steve Jobs got paid, I think it was $5,000 as a bonus for completing this in 4 days. He did excellent, effective man management, obviously. And he paid the Woz like $750 or something. Oh, no. Yeah, he paid him $750, which he said was half of what he got paid. Nothing's changed. So back during the 70s, art, music, and et cetera, were all hard-coded into the circuitry, well, often hard-coded into the circuitry. So things would be programmed, but you'd also have a lot of hardware on chip to do things like music and stuff like that. In the 1980s, you start seeing the IBM XT, stuff like that, coming to prominence, and IBM clones, and these graphical adventure games, point and click and stuff like that, Space Quest and King's Quest and all those from Sierra games. These had sprites for the first time, but these had much more complicated sprites, so you had artists being able to design things like they couldn't before with like 16 colours and stuff. There was an example of a game from this time on Commodore 64 called Elite, which had procedurally generated worlds. I don't know, does anyone here remember Elite? Yeah. It was on the Amiga too, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
so that was an early example of a procedurally generated game. In the 90s, something crazy happened when we moved to 3D. I think Wolfenstein was released in 1988. And so we went all 3D and we started having to make much bigger teams to create all the assets in the game. Wolfenstein actually just had sprites that were always front on, but... So the first person shooter was born, which kind of changed everything. Hundreds of assets, thousands of assets. Oh, no, hundreds of thousands. What? Hundreds of assets per game. Back in the Wolfenstein days, there were hundreds of assets per game. And then we hit 2000, and we get games like GTA, which have movie-sized budgets. So the thing is, like, how do we keep up with that? We're writing open source games. We don't have those kind of resources. Most of us don't even know any artists.
I
don't
know.
Yeah, how do we keep up with this? How do we create assets ourselves without having access to those kind of resources? So that's the whole aim of talking, to try and put some ideas in your head to generate assets. So the idea is to generate complexity from simplicity. We're trying to write simple algorithms to have complex emergent outputs. Here's some examples of simplicity and chaos. So here's chaos, here's order, and this is complexity. Sure.
No, but right away.
So complexity is somewhere in between chaos and order. It's hard to define, it's hard to say what complexity is because it's tied into the way that we perceive things and patterns that we see and stuff like that. So basically, if you want to try and define it, you can say it requires CPU time to generate rather than being a packed format of just a bunch of data. You've got to actually generate the data on the fly using your algorithm. And rather than having humans generate that data. It's non-linear, so if you have systems which don't which have memory systems which don't always respond in the same kind of way. So you get emergent behaviors. I'll show you an example of that later. It's high dimensional, so you have lots of different variables going into into your complex system. And small changes in the initial state yield vastly different outcomes. So the old butterfly effect, you get butterfly floods of things in Nigeria, you get a hurricane somewhere else. Those are the kinds of things we're trying to discover. And the reason for that is because they're interesting. Chaos isn't very interesting. And order at the other end of the spectrum is very interesting. But if you get patterns emerging out of those, a combination of those two, then you can succeeded. John Hopkins was talking about SimCity, and he said people naturally attribute cause and effect relationships to events in SimCity that will, as a programmer knows, are not actually related. So this is what emergent behavior is, when you program something, but you get something even way more complex and unpredictable coming out of it. And I think another example of this might be in Quake, when you get these things, Quake runs, Quake done quick and all that. Yeah. Do you guys know about that? Basically, people try and exploit the physics of the game Quake to get through the level quickly and cheat and do all kinds of cool stuff. Will Wright, I've already mentioned him a couple of other times in this talk because he's one of the big proponents of this, said the one thing that all the sim games really emphasize more than anything else is the shape of chaos. You can have what seems like a fairly simple system, but a few things interacting can lead to wildly unpredictable behavior. So that's exactly what I'm talking about. Shape of chaos, making it more interesting rather than just randomness. Will Wright's The Sims is the top-selling game of all time. And if we look at other games that do really well, they all have an element of this emergence. They're not they've got something happening behind the scenes. This is, if anyone can focus on that, one of those 3D seeing eye things is the actual Mandelbrot set. Did I
just
replace it? Fractals, we all know what fractals are. We've all seen a Mandelbrot set, we've all done those zooming programs into them, they look pretty. The definition of a fractal is a geometric object which has a Hausdorff specific dimension greater than a topological dimension. I don't know what the hell that means. Yeah. So in 1975, this guy, Benoit Mandelbrot, coined the term fractal to describe the math he was interested in. But before him, he was writing a book at the time called How Long is the Code Difference, Statistical Self-Similarity and the Fractal Dimension. But he was looking at the mathematics of self-similarity, which is what fractals are about. There were a couple of other guys working with him, Gaston Maurice Julia, Leibniz, and Louis Fry Richardson. Gaston Maurice Julia, the Julia fractal is named after him. That's a four-dimensional fractal, I think. And, Leibniz was concerned with recursive self-similarity, so systems that are self-similar recursively. And Louis Fry Richardson was interested in coastline. So, the main points of fractals is down here. Iteration, self-similarity. So doing something many times, running the same result through the same system again and again, and getting systems that are similar to themselves at different levels, different dimensions. So, so what are fractals good for? There are three different types of base fractals. So the one we all know is the Mandelbrot fractal, which is escape time fractal. You take a point, you have an area, and you take every single point in that area, and you iterate a function for each point. And whether if it shoots off into nowhere, it's a 1. If it stays within the same location, it's 0. And you get these weird patterns emerging. That's what an escape time fractal is. That's what we've all seen. Iterated function fractals are stuff like the Koch curve. So that's basically like...
I think it's better from the last one you looked at.
Okay. So you draw the Koch algorithm is basically on every face turned into a triangle. So you start off with a triangle, and then each face of this triangle you draw a triangle on it. And then each one of those, you have another little triangle, so a little triangle pop out here. And yes, it may. Thing that quickly snowballs into something really amazingly complicated. And you can get crazy 3D ones of these. I'm sure you guys have seen the sponges that have an infinite number of cubes and stuff like that. My friend had this idea for an infinite fractal Coke bottle where you can just hold an infinite amount of Coke in it. So, how do we use fractals in games? The two main uses are generating height maps for landscapes, and the other one is L systems. L systems aren't in that much use, but they're pretty cool. This down here, I believe, is a Julia fractal rendered in three dimensions. Julia fractals are really cool because because of the four-dimensional fractal, you can animate it through time using the fourth dimension as time. So you can get these weird warping effects. I've got heaps of demos for this, and I'm just trying to remember if I've took one. No, I haven't yet. Okay. This is a quote here. If you already know what recursion is, just remember the answer. Otherwise, find someone who's standing close to the shoulder and pops down. So, Doug Popdown has a whole book full of this kind of stuff. Called Good Elevation and Bark, The Eternal Golden Grade. I'm sure some of you have read it. Pretty amazing book. So let's move on to procedurally generating landscapes. Stochastic fractals, actually, I didn't talk about the three types fully, did I? I talked about gate time and iterated function. The third type of fractal is a stochastic fractal, so one where you have an element of randomness in your iteration. So to generate a landscape, what you do is you start out with a plane or a triangle, so a simple shape, and then you divide it into smaller planes or triangles. So say from the midpoint of each point of each triangle, of each piece of the triangle, you make another triangle. And each time you do that, you move the midpoint up or down randomly. And you keep doing that, so you start out with this massive triangle like this, you split it into smaller and smaller bits, and you end up with something that's interesting, you know, it's like kind of wavy and interesting. I'll just show a quick... This is installed in Debian by default. Someone's obviously done this. They've got the planar one, and it just keeps recursing until you get really fascinating shapes like that. That's one of the big things that it's used for, is terrain generation. And you can actually get terrain generation programs that just generate landscape loops. So this isn't an accurate model of real geological processes. So you get interesting landscapes, but you don't get terribly realistic landscapes. And they're quite uniform. You can start doing other things to eliminate that. So I don't have time to go into all the different things you can do, but basically things like not just moving the points up and down, using the normal of the last plane to move in that direction. It'd be interesting to see if someone came up with a fast system for accurately modeling geological processes to make landscapes. So that's amazing. You have scale issues. But you can use a level of detail algorithm to deal with this. So what a level of detail algorithm does is, when an object is in the distance, so a 3D mesh is in the distance, it finds the minimum number of points in that 3D mesh that it has to compute, and just draws those ones, just calculates those. There's a couple of them is roam, which splits triangles recursively until the required level of detail is reached. So it starts out with just the outline of the object, and then it goes in and in and in and makes more and more detail until, so if you close up, it'll draw heaps of polygons far away, it'll draw fewer. Or adaptive quad trees, which create a data structure, which lends itself well to dropping the poly count of the model. And the other thing to think about when you're doing that kind of thing is scale issues, which you get when you have very large numbers and very small numbers on the screen at the same time. So if you're making a game where you travel between planets and you've got all your landscapes on every planet drawn with a calculated with a stochastic fractal, you want to have a system which can take into account when the planet's really far away and when it's got really close. So floating point numbers might not be big enough if you're dealing with real universe scales. Static versus dynamic generation of data.
Right.
What this is about is procedurally generating content doesn't have to happen on the fly. So you don't have to load up the computer and then it's calculating everything as it goes in your game. You can generate the data and save it statically to disk. And some games actually do this. They generate a whole section of levels or whatever, store it to disk, and then later they can load it back up again. So that's the way to save CPU. It's always a trade-off between with these kind of algorithms between memory and CPU. For that particular algorithm, you can use fractal Brownian motion, which is this equation here. It goes on forever. Do a tab anymore. And that gives a much less uniformly random, so it doesn't just give you rolling mountains, it can give you sharp peaks and then flat planes and stuff like that. It's Fellin noise plus the fractal algorithm, basically. I'll talk about Fellin noise a bit later. Now I'm going to move on to L-systems. These are my favorite. I love L-systems. An L-system is an iterator.
Is this where the log component comes in?
Sorry?
The log component.
Just a bit of log. An iterated function fractal. It's an iterated function fractal. So it's another one of these fractals which is made by recursively doing the same operation on set of data. A guy called Aristide Lindemeyer studied the growth of algae from fungi and yeast, so he was like studying bacterial growth. And he came up with the way of describing the growth of an algae. And then his student, whose name I have no idea how to say, he and Aristide Lindemeyer wrote a book called The Algorithmic Beauty of Plants, which is the quintessential. Literature on the subject. It was the first one to go, hey, look, you can make plants with math. There's another one which doesn't use this technique, but it can generate ferns through a similar fractal technique. But that's another time. L system can basically be described in math like this. You've got the grammar of G, the alphabet of possible symbols. So you have a set of possible symbols, V. You have a set of constants which don't change, and then you have an initial state. And then you have the rules of production. So the rules of production are basically what you're doing is on each iteration you're taking your initial state and you're substituting symbols within it with their rules of production. So you'll have like a symbol A, and you'll have a rule of production A is to AB, and then you'll have B is to B, for example. Then every time you see A, you're replacing with AB, and every time you see B, you just replace with B. And you keep doing that as many times as you want. You can iterate how many times you want. And eventually you get these long, complicated strings. In order to turn them into plant-like structures, what we do is we use a logo-like drawing system, which has a stack which you can pop and push off, and the symbols become graphic commands. So has anyone here used logo? Yeah, pretty cool. When you go forward, turn left, 20 degrees forward, that's basically all we're doing, and then you pop back to your original position. I'll show you an example. This is a little bit of code I wrote, and it's just very primitive, generates a 2D plant. And you can tweak, it's really fascinating tweaking the values and watching it just branch out all over the place. But I'll show you another much better one. This is actually written in a graphical data flow programming language called Pure Data. Has anyone heard of Pure Data? It's mostly used for audio processing, but you can do graphics with it too. This is the example. And the cool thing about Pure Data is we can just grab variables here and move them. Oh, I should change. So that one there is extending the length of each individual segment. You can see it's made up of segments which change angles like this. If I change the angle at which that looks like the trunk angle, I think he's actually got a two-layer algorithm where he's handling the branches and the trunk separately. But it's basically an L system still, he's just got more commands.
That build system stuff, it's going to actually use for erosion, so they'll generate a height map of what something looks like, and then they'll do erosion over the top of that, and it'll pull the surface of it and actually like create gullies and stuff.
Oh, right.
And it uses that same sort of model.
That's cool. So that's like what I was talking about earlier with the landscaping system. You could have a system which was more realistic.
Yeah.
Well, you can email me. I know it was actually quite hard to get hold of because it's so complicated, it looks random. You can throw a random element in there. You don't have to.
That triangle behind you, could that be done as an L system as well?
I think so, yeah.
Turn each line into line, turn right, turn left, line.
Two data in Debian and Ubuntu.
Yeah, you can apt-get install two data and apt-get install gem. Gem is the name of the graphics add-on for it. I'm going to have to go really fast through my next I was going to talk about algorithmic audio, but then last night I had a conversation with Rastaman where he was dissing it. But now I probably don't have time, so. Yeah, basically, write algorithmic music. An example of algorithmic music is Bach. He used to have a bunch of transformations which he would apply to a melody, and he would come up with these amazingly complex things, and then he would like improvise over the top of them. There's a couple of famous pieces. I think one of them, I don't know what it was called, but the king at the time, of Prussia or something, gave him a little melody, and then he used these transformations to write this really amazing tune. So you can do that kind of thing, but algorithmic music generally sounds pretty crap. I don't want to. It's very hard to do it well, you know what I mean? But there are amazing geniuses out there now who do it as well. The other aspect of algorithmic audio is on-the-fly sound effects. So not using, these days sound in games is pretty primitive. Everything's just triggered samples. Maybe they put some 3D in there, but basically there's no reality to it. So if I knock a piece of wood, it doesn't sound the same both times I hit it, because after the first time I hit it, the wood's changed slightly, you know, there's very slight differences. But in a game, they just use a sample. Yeah, so you can use physical modelling to try and emulate real-world sound. Myself, I've in the past used physical modelling to generate samples, so kind of a big purpose, but it does mean you don't have to go out and make field recording. Spatial audio is another way of affecting the sound effects algorithmically, and speech, you can generate speech, of course we all know about speech, but right. cellular automata. Okay. So, we all know what cellular automata are, right? The Game of Life. Generalized version of the Game of Life. But the Game of Life was pretty much the first famous one that came along in the 70s. But before that, there was a guy called John von Neumann, you might have heard of, he was trying to think up ways for robots to self-replicate themselves. And this other guy, Stanislaw Ulam, was studying crystallography and the ways that crystals grow. And Stanislaw had developed these mathematical abstractions to describe what was happening. And John von Neumann said, hey, those are pretty cool, maybe I'll try. And Stanislaw actually persuaded him to try self-replicating robots algorithmically. I've seen a really great cellular automata, which was someone actually designed, I can't remember what the rule set was, I don't think it was Game of Life, but someone designed a full computer in a finite state machine. So, I mean, not a finite state, in a cellular automata. So he'd come up with ways to do logic gates and or all that kind of thing, and he'd come up with pathways. It's really amazing to watch. They have a webpage of it. It's just a massive, complicated thing. And you can see the bits slipping in the memory and everything. So you have much rules to find the state of each cell. The grid doesn't have to be square. That's one thing. Like a lot of people think that it has to be square, but there are heaps of cellular automata with. And they're not uniform space even. Sometimes cells touch other cells that are further away. There's all kinds of different things you can do. So you can use them to design AI or design textures, dynamic textures as an example. I've got an example here. You all would have seen this before. I think it's in the Quake intro, actually. Java's going to probably crash everything.
There you go.
Yeah. Looks pretty wicked. Oh, 10 minutes? Okay. All right, we're going around now. Yeah. So, that's what cellular automata can be used for. Think about textures to morph, textures to change, that kind of cool thing, water. This is an example of a cellular automata acting in real life. So obviously the cell on the surface of this shell, each have a little rule within them that follows a cellular automata-like mathematical progression. And they end up with things that look just like many of the cellular automata we know. Fascinating. When we imagine the first day a mathematician picked up one of these and went, holy crap, that's a cellular automata. These are my favorite genetic algorithms. So computational methods for simulating real-world evolution. So basically, you've got strings of data, and you're evolving them in a way that's similar to how evolution happens in the real world. You've got to have, it's good for finding solutions incrementally, so working towards a solution, rather than having... Yeah, it's good for the situations where you have, like, say, an NP-complete problem, where the only way to solve an NP-complete problem is to come up with every solution and look at the best one. That's the only way to get the optimal. So, in that case, genetic algorithms are quite good because they're better at getting you into the rough area. They're better than other systems like simulated annealing, which is where you jump around randomly. So, basically, for finding a solution, you need to have a fitness function. Determining each string of data, how fit is it compared to the other ones? And then you need to have an end state function which tells you, yep, we found the best solution we're going to find. Let's get out of here. The basic process is much like real life. Select a subpopulation for reproduction. Recombine genes. So put your two data strings together in some way. So maybe you're going to take every second one in each one and then recombine them and then chop off the end or something. There's many different ways to do it. One of the problems I found in this area is there are so many different ways to perform genetic algorithms, so many different ways to write genetic algorithms, but there's not enough science in it. People are just kind of going, oh, well, I'll select that number, this amount for how much mutation I'm going to put in the system, and it's still being explored, and I think it'll be being explored for quite a long time. But for games, we're just trying to get something cool happening. So it's good for that. You then do the mutation phase where you might change, flip off a couple of bits, flip on somewhere, some other, chain one letter so it's the next, something like that. And then you evaluate the fitness of the new population and select the survivors, so you kill off a bunch of the data streams that you have according to your fitness function. So you use your fitness function and go, yep, we'll keep that data, and we won't keep that. genetic programming is where you take those strings and you actually use them in a virtual machine to run something. So that's a wicked video I've been showing.
My favorite.
What?
We've got nothing incriminating
in my bin
directory. Yes, this is a guy called Carl Sims. He was experimenting with genetic algorithms, and what he was doing was mutating these objects, which were made up of polygons and then some kind of physical merger or something like that. And he actually got them to...
The empathy was used to determine survival. Most of the creatures are results from independent evolutions. Some developed strategies similar to those in real life.
Once
they're evolved, multiple copies of these creatures can be made and simulated together in the same environment. The next group of creatures will evolve for their ability to run on a simulated environment, gravity and friction. Some simple solutions with just two parts were found. Some seem like they could use some This group was evolved for their jumping ability. Here, some covered the cube with protective arms. Others simply unfolded onto the cube. Here are two similar hockey strategies, battling it off.
I mean, it's extraordinarily lifelike, isn't it?
Yeah. The strategy is this two-arm technique that swipes quickly in from the side and moves the cube over to a second arm. These are final rounds of competition amongst the overall best. Finally, the seeker arm goes against the side swiper, but the cube is just out of reach.
That's one of my favorite videos. Love that. Okay, so that's genetic algorithms. I won't go too much into random number generation or what is random 5 minutes. Okay, cool. You guys are all into computers, you know about the issues surrounding randomness, what is randomness, and cryptography and things like that. And the problems they have with computers not being able to generate random numbers. But this Mersenne Twister is an excellent example of a random number generator for games. It's not cryptographically secure, but it has a large period, so no repetition for a long time. It's fast, it's advanced by a few Japanese guys, and it's a great game. Very simple to calculate. The other cool random, well, it's not a random function, but it uses randomness within it, Perlin Noise. Ken Perlin invented Perlin Noise when he was working on the movie Tron. Lots of the textures and stuff in Tron are based on that. And you see it all the time now. It's very natural looking. It's three-dimensional with the values normalized between -1 and 1. Basically what you do is you have noise functions and you sum them at different frequencies and amplitudes. So you don't just get a noise function, you get a self-similar noise function. And it's a fractal type of noise. Generally people use for each consecutive stage twice the frequency and half the amplitude. Alright, boys. This guy called Craig Reynolds came up with boys. They're lifelike automatons that can move around and be aware of their flock mates. So it's really good for simulating flocking. The movie Jurassic Park used Craig Reynolds' algorithm when on that in that scene when the, all the raptors are running across the field. Yeah, and what I love about it is it's really simple. It's got these three rules. Basically, you just have a vector, and you just add up vectors for each rule. So your first vector is an avoidance vector. You've got your local flock mates around you, and you don't want to hit them. So you have calculated an avoidance vector away from all of them. The next thing is to steer towards the average heading of your local flock mates. So you take the heading that all of them are pointing at, and you go, yeah, okay, I'll adopt the average of all of that. The next one is to steer to move towards the average position of them. So you're actually trying to stay in the center of your flock. So those three vectors put together makes this really remarkable flocking behavior. So we've got another Java one here. Yeah, this is an example of some flocking happening in 3D. And there's great, KFish has an excellent example of flocking on its homepage. So search for KFish flock or KFish void, and Craig Rowell's page has heaps of info on it. So these, you can see these polygons are all flocking together in three-dimensional space. And the great thing about it is, because it's just adding vectors together, if you want to add other behaviors to your being, your non-player characters, you can do that really easily. So by you can add path following algorithms to make them follow some path, or an object avoidance algorithm. Finish up?
Yep.
Yep, okay. So basically that's everything anyway. So the idea is to shape random, use simple algorithms to get complex output, and let's say massively multiplayer online game using each of the techniques we've described. How come that be?
You get to choose one.
Cool.
There are different types, so if you prefer white, I think the white man's gone. We're going to take a break for about 5 minutes, and then Rusty is talking about West Nile next. So, don't go anywhere.